Israel's deadly and unrelenting assault on Gaza following Hamas's October 7 attack on Israel has had repercussions around the world. In Gaza itself, the death toll is over 40,000, and the humanitarian crisis worsens every day. In the United States, as students are headed back to campus, colleges and universities are bracing for a new round of protests and counter-protests. Israel's war in Gaza is dividing the Democratic Party, just as Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are seeking to unite their party to stop Donald Trump from returning to the White House. Recent surveys show that 48% of Americans oppose Israel's military action in Gaza, while 42% support it. But today on Law and Disorder, instead of the big picture, we're going to take a look at opposition to Israel's war in Gaza from a very personal point of view. We're joined today by Larry Hebert, a very unlikely candidate to become an outspoken protester against U.S. military support for Israel, who would gain national and international attention. Larry Hebert is a 26-year-old U.S. Air Force senior airman and avionics technician assigned to Naval Station Rota in Spain, having served 6 years so far in the military. At 10 a.m. on Easter Sunday, March 31st, 2024, on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House, Hebert began a hunger strike during an authorized leave from his post in Spain. Shortly before his hunger strike, he joined Veterans for Peace, an organization that opposes U.S. military actions. The organization argues that U.S. weapons shipments to Israel is a violation of U.S. law. In a press release issued by Veterans for Peace, the purpose of Hebert's hunger strike was described as highlighting, quote, the plight of the starving children of Gaza, unquote. Hebert wore a sign that read, quote, active duty airman refuses to eat while Gaza starves, unquote, with a photograph of an emaciated Palestinian infant. Hebert said he was inspired by the self-immolation of 25-year-old serviceman Aaron Bushnell, who died on February 25, 2024, outside the Israeli embassy in Washington. Before he died, Bushnell declared he would, quote, no longer be complicit in the genocide in Gaza. Hebert's hunger strike lasted 9 days, but ended abruptly on April 9 when he was ordered to report immediately to Andrews Air Force Base for a return flight to his post in Spain. Hebert is pursuing release from active duty as a conscientious objector. Larry Hebert, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, sir.
To begin with, please tell us about yourself, your upbringing, and your attitudes toward the U.S. military back then when you signed up in 2018.
Yes, so I had a fairly pro-American upbringing. My family is right-wing and love our country and have always been strong supporters of our country and our policy. So I always had a love for this country and a respect for the military, but I never saw myself actually joining the military until I started working at a restaurant and I met a lot of veterans that had already retired and, you know, done their service. And I met people from all the branches, and all of them told me that I could really jumpstart my life and create a really solid foundation going forward if I were to join the military. And then On top of that, of course, all the benefits and the opportunity to travel and learn a trade. So I was obviously very enticed by that. And when, dozens of people are telling you the exact same thing, it's kind of hard not to take that advice. So I joined mostly because of that advice. And then I also had a child on the way. So I figured, working at a dead-end job isn't going to support my family going forward. So that was the real motivation for joining. And I wasn't super like gung-ho and like brainwashed military, but I still had a respect and underlying love for the military.
Well, Larry, this is Jim Lafferty, and it's already been said that you were inspired to take the action you took because of Aaron Bushnell and what he had done by way of killing himself, indeed, in protest of the U.S. support for Israel's war in Gaza. So describe that reaction to us. Tell us more about that reaction that, as I say, ended up inspiring you to take your own protest and your own, in your case, fast for peace.
Yeah, at the time, I was already ready to get out of the military. I thought, however, that I was just going to ride out the remainder of my contract and get out quietly. But in February, when Aaron Bushnell self-immolated, it was kind of like an inspiration. It kind of like reignited like something in me that I knew that, just riding out the remainder of my contract wasn't going to be enough. Like, nobody else was going to step up to the plate and do something. And Aaron Bushnell obviously did that. He stepped up and really led this charge for service members to be speaking out. Ultimately, I waited to see what was going to be the response from the government and then within the military. Basically, both sides remained quiet about the entire situation. I was shown a letter from a representative, I believe Tom Cotton, and it was addressed to the Secretary of Defense, Austin Lloyd. I can't remember the exact verbiage, but he was basically asking him why he wasn't addressing extremism within the ranks. And I found it kind of ironic because the extremists aren't the ones that want an end to violence and an end to war. The extremists are the ones that continue violence and continue warfare and profit from it. I couldn't just sit there and just allow them to just not speak on Aaron and not highlight what he did and why he did it. So I went to DC pretty much immediately after about 2 weeks, and I met with organizations like Code Pink, Veterans for Peace, kind of figure out what I was going to do. I thought maybe talking to politicians might help, and that did not give me any sort of satisfaction. They're just kind of, a one-line media talking points, so that was unsuccessful. And then I got to a breaking point where I thought I would ultimately have to do something enormous for media to even bother to cover it. I talked to a lot of good people that advised me, and I ultimately ended up coming up with a hunger strike, which I had done no research for previously. And I mostly was inspired to do that because of all of the news articles that were coming out about the starvation that was happening in Gaza.
Larry, you mentioned Veterans for Peace. Had you known of the group before? Did you learn more about them in this connection? Tell us about the organization and what they stand for and what role they played in your decision to go to Washington.
Yeah, I had no prior knowledge of any veterans organizations prior to going to DC. So I was actually introduced to them prior to my hunger strike by former Colonel Ann Wright. She got me connected to Veterans for Peace and ultimately connected me with pretty much everyone I know. She was a really guiding force when I was there in DC, and it was really inspirational to hear her actions when she was serving and everything that she's done since. I was not aware of Veterans for Peace prior, but they helped me along the entire process once I did get connected with them, and they've been extremely helpful ever since. They're an organization that's been around for 40 years, and they were obviously highlighting the atrocities in Vietnam, and they've always done good things.
Larry, you obviously got some press initially on March 31st when you began your protest and your hunger strike. And I suspect in the course of that, you met a number of interesting people, just folks walking by or others who reached out to you. Tell us a bit about how your protest went and the kinds of folks and the individuals who came up to greet you or express an opinion one way or another about what you were doing.
The protest itself was obviously a challenge. I had never done anything like that before, and I, again, hadn't researched hunger strikes prior, but I had a couple friends and individuals that have done hunger strikes, and they advised me a little bit on how to go about it. But the people I met during the hunger strike was probably the most interesting part of the hunger strike, because I met people, I met veterans from all sorts of wars, and I met individuals from that were displaced in Iraq and Afghanistan, and hearing their testimony and what they've been through and how they've been impacted by the U.S. military was extremely heartbreaking. And every single person I talked to that had been displaced or had family members killed through the United States' intervention, and it reaffirmed like what I was standing for, and it just continued to speak life and motivation into my message. So that's something that I'll always remember. I mean, there was a few specific individuals that I'd love to go over everybody, but I know one individual two individuals took train rides out to come see me in DC. I think one was from Louisiana and one was from New Jersey. That was amazing. And I had one individual, I think he ran about an hour to come see me. All the people that came out to see me, I'm highly grateful for.
Larry, how did you explain to people your decision to engage in this? What was your message? And even now, in the months that have followed, are you reinforced in what you've done? How did you talk to people you greeted? And also, how have you talked to servicemen back in Spain and others who may have contacted you?
I haven't initiated the conversation with people. I think basically everyone is aware what I did and what I was speaking out against. So I know that if I were to approach people versus them approaching me, I already know the conversation either wouldn't happen or it would just not be a beneficial conversation. So, but I will admit that I'm very surprised at how many people have come up and initiated conversations with me and how many people have been very supportive. People I've basically never even talked to before came up to me and praised what I did and thanked me for speaking out. There's definitely an alarming number of service members that oppose the genocide in Gaza and just refuse to speak out publicly, mostly because it's a taboo topic. If you speak out against the genocide in Gaza, you're essentially speaking out against U.S. policy.
I'm Jim Lafferty, and along with Steve Rohde, we are co-hosting at this moment and talking with Larry Hebert. Larry is a member of the Air Force who went on a hunger strike in protest of the Israeli war in Gaza and the U.S. support for that war. And now, Larry, you were a member of the Armed Services, the Air Force, for some time before you decided to file a conscientious objector claim and be removed and get yourself out of military service. Can you tell us what happened to you during that period of time, what you experienced, saw, thought about during that period of time that led you to file that conscientious objector claim? and then also the current status of your application. How has the military reacted to it so far? And to your protest, for that matter, as well.
I actually looked into conscientious objector application very early on, around the November timeframe of 2023. And I knew I had to get out. But at that time, when I was initiating that conversation about conscientious objection, I didn't think I would qualify. And that was mostly due to not having a formulated opinion on national self-defense. I was very pro personal self-defense, and I thought that national self-defense was essentially the same morally. But as time went on, and once I went to DC, I started to really look back into previous conflicts and how conflicts could have been avoided entirely, and what the solution is, really, and why national self-defense maybe isn't the best option. I started looking up a lot of anti-war activists and anti-war racketeers like General Smedley Butler. I listened to multiple presidents like Kennedy, Eisenhower, and Carter, and I figured out through a lot of these resources that the whole motivation behind war is essentially for monetary gain, for the ruling class, as Aaron Bushnell would call it. There's not a true like enemy that we're going after. The United States is trying to obtain resources, like whether it's oil or land, and none of it is personally directed at any group of people. So I find that fairly disturbing and evil, and I think the overwhelming ignorance towards the war propaganda and the motivations of war has just continued to lead us into more and more conflicts. And now today, there's a literal genocide going on against the defenseless people, ultimately. And nobody seems to, I mean, obviously people care and have been speaking out, but there's an alarming number of people that either just don't know or just don't care.
Larry, I think anyone who listens to your story and gets to know you is impressed by your courage, given where you came from on these issues and where you've landed and the way you discuss your deeply held beliefs. Others may be listening who want to take action, who want to be courageous. Where did you find the courage in your own values to take these very visible actions, even as you are a member of the military? Tell us the exact status of your conscientious objector application and your status within the military right now.
So currently, I'm just doing menial work for the military, and my application is moving along at a fairly normal rate. I wouldn't be able to disclose exactly where it's at, just out of respect for each individual office and everyone along that process. But I think a rough projection date for approval would be around the December to June timeframe. So it's quite a bit away, but it is coming up. And then the motivating factor for me speaking out was Aaron Bushnell, and that kind of, again, it got me motivated enough to speak out and take action. But I think that I've always really stuck to my beliefs, and I've always stuck to fairness and what is right. And so I've always been a vocal advocate against immorality and wrongdoings. And I haven't been, obviously, in the news or anything doing it, just amongst my peers and coworkers. But I think it's important that people stand by their morals and stand by their beliefs, because without that, then there's honestly no point. We're just all essentially just living out our lives and just not giving a care about anything. And I think for others, I think it's extremely important too to highlight that no one person is going to change things, is going to change policy, and it's more community based. It's a collection of people. I was hoping that with Aaron Bushnell that things would change and things would end. And I was always kind of, at that time, I felt like I was always waiting for that change to happen. And that change doesn't come unless you take action. Waiting for someone else to come save the day is ultimately what's stopping change from happening. We all have to take action and be a part of change.
Larry, I wonder, you were on a authorized leave when you decided to engage in this hunger strike as your protest as to what was happening to the people in Gaza. And then that was canceled, apparently, and they brought you back into active duty. Had they not done that, had the military not done that, had you resolved in your own mind to continue on your hunger strike for much longer? And if so, for how long? Was it possible for you to do that in any way, shape, or form once you were brought back to the military?
I think a lot of the confusion about why I was recalled, I think a lot of people think that I was recalled because of the hunger strike and because of my protests and speaking out, speaking to media. It was actually due to me trying to address the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. I went to a hearing that he was speaking at, and I tried to address him, and he simply shrugged me off and ignored me. And later that evening, his office sent out a memo to my command detailing the incident in a way that really negatively highlighted me. That wasn't entirely accurate. So that was actually why I got recalled. So, but if I hadn't been recalled, I would have continued the hunger strike for as long as I could have. I know there were a lot of people that were supporting me and that were very grateful of my empathy and my courage, but some people had mentioned that I don't have to harm myself in order to make change. And that was something that really touched me, was that they, even though there's people whose family, like Palestinians, like their families there that are being killed on a daily basis and are starving and dealing with injuries, they're still concerned with me. I'm obviously going to be okay. Like I'm in the United States and I had a doctor checking on me. But yeah, that was extremely impactful to be a witness to people who were undergoing a genocide and still have the empathy to say, Larry, please stop starving yourself. Like, you don't need to do this.
Larry, how can listeners learn more about Veterans for Peace? And are you on Facebook, or can people follow your case in any way?
Yeah, Veterans for Peace is on social media. There's also a website. There's a lot of different chapters kind of across the country, and everybody's kind of doing their own part that they can. And we work with all sorts of organizations that obviously work towards peace. So usually you can find the current events going on the website, but the social media obviously will have quite a bit of updates as well. And then my case, I probably won't update my case publicly until it is approved or very close to being approved.
Well, Larry Hebert, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Law and Disorder, to compliment you and salute you for standing up for what you believe in. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
This is Forbes Avenue, WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Aubriana Bench, and I'm here with Ben Carter.
Hi there.
Do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, what you do?
I'm the scene shop supervisor in the School of Drama here at Carnegie Mellon, and also an instructor teaching a few classes.
How long have you been here for?
Just finishing my 35th year.
During my brief research into what you do, I saw that you are a CMU alum.
Yes, it's true. I graduated in 1984.
Oh, what made you decide to come back here?
They called me. I was originally a drama student for a year, and then I switched to sculpture and graduated from there and went out and worked for 3 years. And then they called me out of the blue and asked me to come back and teach. So the rest is history.
I heard through the grapevine, because we know each other, that you have experience working on feature films.
Yes, it's true. Yes, that is correct.
I saw that it was like construction, special props, and consulting. How did you get introduced to doing this?
One of the things that the sculpture world teaches you is that there's no jobs in the sculpture world if you get a sculpture degree. But what it does teach you also is that there are businesses out there that use all the same technologies and techniques and materials and strange problem-solving strategies that dovetail very nicely into that. And the one business that I still had kind of a background interest in was entertainment, motion pictures, television, etc. And when I started here at CMU, that is what this department is. And then because of my woodworking experience, I immediately got a job on a movie building specialty stunt props for Night of the Living Dead, which was being shot here in Pittsburgh. And we had to do a custom railing for somebody to fall through. And that was a perfect segue from one discipline into the other. And from there, it was just, oh, you can do that? Oh, you've done that? Next thing you know, here we are many, many years later. So
that's really cool. How many films have you done since then?
20-some, but I stopped doing it about 10 years ago because it was too many other things going on. But it will consume your life completely. And I was doing it as a side job on top of my full-time job. And it's easily a full-time job on its own, especially if there's more than one movie in town, then you just don't sleep. So, yeah, I mean, I could go back over and count how many it is if somebody really needed an actual number, but it's over 20, so...
What was it like going from that experience and then coming back to CMU? Like, how are maybe like the people different in that field? And then
we are that field, the drama department. We train those people to go out into that business. So it's the same bunch of crazies that you deal with, and the same ridiculous deadlines, and the same budgets, the same lack of sleep, the same intensity of work, attention to detail. It's very, very, very rewarding and very, very fast paced. And our department is very, very much the same way too. So our students are really, really pushed really, really hard to get the best out of them. And that is what the entertainment industry is very, very much based on, that mentality too. So they really expect people to just show up and give 100% or more all the time, every day, until the show's over. And then everybody goes in their own way, and then somebody else comes in and starts it all. And that's just to get things done that fast and that accurately, again and again and again. There's very, very little room for taking a breath or making any mistakes. So that's what we train.
Yeah, so it's just different place, but same exact type,
yes,
type of people, same,
yes,
vibe.
Yeah, it's very, very similar. And the big, big difference is the movie business pays so much better.
What films did you do? Like, maybe what was one of your favorites that you worked on?
We've done bits and pieces on a lot of them, but one of the ones that we had the most work on was a film called Striking Distance. It was a Bruce Willis film that they shot here a while back in 1992. And that was just an entire summer of all, not all day every day, because I was working here doing pre-college as well. There was just, we were doing special props on that movie, so they just needed various things like a huge pile of artificial rock cocaine. They needed a rubber shotgun that they could smack somebody with. It was shot on the rivers, so they had a police boat that they needed to have completely outfitted with all the electronics and lights and siren and all that stuff, so we did all that. They had a van that they just handed us, a blank van, and said, hey, turn this into a broadcast media van. So we had to put all the antennas and all the telescoping satellite dishes, which we all had to build everything from scratch too. Yeah. So it's a really wide variety of stuff that they ask you to do, and you never know what you're going to get, because, and that's the nature of the business too, is they have something in their mind, and they show you a napkin sketch, and they say, can you build this? And then they say, how much? And you kind of come up with an idea how you're going to build it, what it's going to be made out of. And very oftentimes you haven't used these materials before, and you just have to sort of trust yourself and just throw yourself into it. And somehow or other, we were never late. They always loved it. I have no idea looking back on it how that ever happened, but it's really, it's so fun, and it's so stressful, and it's really neat compared to the theater world, because you can always go back years later to this day. I can go on YouTube, pull up any one of those movies and any one of those segments, and scroll through the segments of those movies and show anybody any of the props that we built, if it made it to the movie, because a lot of things you make, they end up on the cutting room floor. They get edited out for whatever time reasons or whatever. But anything that did make the movie, you can always go on there and say, scroll through and say, yeah, there it is. There is Ben Affleck stabbing Matt Damon with this knife that you made. So it's really fun. And there's a history. It's documented. So that's what I like about it, compared to doing theater work where everything goes in the dumpster.
Yeah.
So.
You keep saying we. Is the we like you and other people at CMU, or did you work with a group?
No, when we were doing movie stuff, I was an independent contractor always.
Okay.
Pretty much. So I didn't join a union or anything. We just had our own shop at home. My wife and I were basically the company. She was a painter more. She would do the custom painting work on things. And I would do all the structural, actual construction of everything. And then periodically, we did a movie called The Piano Lesson, an August Wilson movie for Hallmark Channel. And they needed a carved piano. And it all had to be carved from scratch. You know, they gave us drawings that they wanted it to match. And there was just too many hours involved carving it. So at that time, I was still connected with the wood shop where I used to work. And we did a lot of hand carving at the wood shop. So I called one of my friends there and hired him to come in and help me. He was a really good master wood carver. So we spent a lot of time together just carving all these wooden panels all over the piano. So depending on who you're working, what your project is, who you're working with, or who you're working for, you can tap back into your former or present lives and get different people with different skill sets to jump in on the project and then jump back out again. And if they're really busy and they don't want to do it, that could be a real problem. But usually you just show them a stack of money and they're like, oh yeah, I have time for that.
Olav, your son, told me that you have a piece of glass from The Silence of the Lambs.
It's a piece of Lexan, yeah.
Yeah. How did you do a lot of props for that movie?
No, I didn't even work on that. We were on another project at that time when that was being filmed here. But it was a piece of Hannibal Lecter's cage, the Lexan panels that somebody had made for the movie, because they don't generally go to the store and buy those things. Most of what you see is made, custom made for stuff like that. And when they tear down sets, a lot of it gets thrown away. A lot of it, if it's very interesting little pieces, people tend to hang on to as mementos of their experience, or if they think that maybe they can use it for something. Well, one of my good friends from back in the day, Lou Taylor, who was the construction coordinator on that movie, he took that with him, one of those panels. Who knows what happened to the other ones, but he took it with him and then brought it onto another movie that I was working called, a Stephen King movie called Dark Half, that was shot here. And they needed that panel as a backing panel in a shower door so they could slam against the shower door without breaking the shower door. And when that movie wrapped, he just happened to have it and said, I know how to do that. I have just a thing for that. We can shine light through it and you can't see it. And then when that movie wrapped, he didn't want that thing anymore. I was helping clean up. And I said, can I have it? And they said, get it out of here. So now that's in my basement. So you do tend to keep things that are kind of unusual and neat. I was going to make a dining table out of it, but I never did.
Okay. I wanted to know the story behind that because I'm just a big horror movie nerd. But I'm talking to Ben Carter, instructor at the theater department in CMU. And I just wanted to keep talking to you about what you were doing in the film scene here. You said that you would do stuff for props like in your backyard. Is that where you would mostly do stuff?
Or in our shop, in our home. We had at that point, when we first started doing it, we had bought a building down on the north side, an old salad dressing factory, and turned it into our house. So we had an apartment, we had a shop, we had a garage, and of course a music room, because you know you have to have a jammer. So, and the shop was a pretty good sized shop, so there was, you know, a metalworking area, a casting and mold making area, a carpentry area, a drafting area, and there was just because you have to use so many different types of technologies and tools and materials, coming back to the sculpture world, it's all those things all just came back together into an actual job that actually works, that actually makes money, that's objective. The sculpture world and art world is completely subjective, and the whole value of everything you do is completely up to the viewer or the art gallery owner, whatever, which is really, really kind of unknown, and you can't count on paying your bills that way. So yeah. All those same technologies and all those same materials and techniques and everything, they all translate directly into entertainment, where you need all that same stuff. And there it is, and it worked, and you can say for sure it's more like an engineering job, where you can say, yes, that actually fulfilled the project goals successfully, and here is your paycheck, moving on, instead of being just sort of surreal and weird, which is the art world. So
I just want to wrap up what we've talked about. Based on when you were involved in it, how was the Pittsburgh film scene in general? I know we've talked a lot about it. I know we've said it's kind of not very different from CMU because it's all the same people, but based on, you know, when you were there, how was it?
At CMU, you mean?
In the Pittsburgh film scene.
Well, it's been going on for 100 years. So, and it kind of comes and goes depending on a lot of different things, you know, tax incentives and things like that. And other cities are always trying to get the money and get the business to come here. And we'll go a year sometimes without something, and then sometimes we'll have three or four films being shot here at once. And right now, Mayor of Kingstown is shooting again. We just drove by the prison today, and there's a row of Haddad's trucks, which is, you know, the local people that support all the logistics of that. So they're still filming away again. I haven't committed my life to the industry, so I'm really sort of superficially involved in it. Like I would just jump in and jump out as needed. I never ever once had to make a phone call and say, hey, does anybody have any work? It's more like I'd be doing something already and somebody would call. Or once people know what you do, they don't want to do job interviews and research. They want to call someone and say, hey, I'm in town, I don't know anybody who does this. And it's relatively small community in this town, about in the movie industry, so everybody knows everybody. So if somebody says, who does special props, there's only a couple people that do it. Now, I don't do it anymore. Unfortunately, there's a couple other people around that took over that and do it on a really large scale. And we still stay in touch and can compare ideas and things now and then, too. But you can't really say it's a thriving industry. There was a point where it was a few years ago, probably 20 years ago, a lot of local carpenters quit their construction jobs and just joined the union and became full-time movie carpenters. And then that's not a good way to do it. You make lots of money for, you know, 6 or 9 months or something like that. And then that movie wraps and they're gone, and then you don't know if another one's coming. Yet you've quit your jobs and you don't know what you're going to do, and then maybe you take on another construction job and another movie comes in. So sometimes they overlap too. So like you're really heavy deep into one and another one starts and they want you to come work for them, yet you're already signed on to this one, and they don't really care if one is already going. So the industry is just like that. And in Pittsburgh, where we're not really historically like LA or something, which is like known for being a movie town, outside of Pittsburgh, it's not as reliable as a source of income, for instance, if you want to dedicate your life and family and your bills to it. So doing it as a subcontractor occasionally was really, really fun and really nice. So it was. Yeah. It's too much now between, you know, life and family and puppies and Airbnbs and things like that. No more.
Yeah. I'm talking with Ben Carter, a theater instructor at CMU. And I want to talk a bit about what you do at CMU now.
Yeah.
Because if you can't hear, we're in the scene shop. Lots of background noise, people talking, movement around. And you have machines here that you can kind of do stuff with. And
Yeah, the nature of a scene shop is kind of interesting, because what we do in the theater is we basically make a microcosm of the real world on stage. So it's all the same materials. It's all, you know, plumbing and electrical and carpentry and metalworking and welding and machining and all the same things that you would have in the real world, except on a much smaller scale. So we have to do bits and pieces of all the things. So if you had to hire a plumber or an electrician or a carpenter to do your house, we have to do all those things in little bits and pieces, but they all have to be just as functional as they would be in your real house, but on stage. And then to support that, our shop has to have the same capabilities as if you were building an entire house, basically, all the same stuff. So we have tons of carpentry equipment. This whole side of the shop is basically for woodworking. That whole side of the shop is basically for metalworking. So we build more and more and more sets out of metals, mostly steel these days. And that all depends on the designer. We never know. So since we do things on a large scale, we like to buy machinery that's sort of scaled up for that we get from the industrial world, the manufacturing sector, basically. So our machines aren't what you would see like in a high school theater shop. They're pulled right from real industrial shops that are designed to run 24 hours a day.
Richard is pointing to the hamburger, like right above your
head.
Okay,
so the hamburger, it's a cheeseburger, actually. They're one of the classes they do here in the advanced paint class is they have to do a sculpture out of something three-dimensionally. And sometimes they're very large. You'll see, like, there's a mastodon head over there and a dinosaur head up there. They make them as part of their graduate thesis projects. And they're usually big, and they're very fancy, and they're super well made. And they graduate, and they can't take that on a plane. So sometimes they just dumpster them, and sometimes it's just like, no, we really want that. So up, it gets hung on the wall or hung on the ceiling, and then that hamburger and that car.
Yeah,
that was actually a prop from a show. But they loved it so much they couldn't bear to scrap it, so they hung it on the wall. We only have so much wall space, you know, so. But like the cheeseburger was just so funny, you know, that we couldn't do anything with it. And at least twice people have come to us and said, we heard you have a giant cheeseburger. And one was a hamburger shop that wanted to borrow it for their opening of their hamburger shop so that they could have it. And somebody else needed it for some show somewhere. So we bring in our lift and we bring it up to take down the cheeseburger. It goes in a crate and goes away. But that's the kind of thing, if it's that cool and it's that easy to hang on to, it's just fun. And it's just, the whole industry is kind of, it's so silly. You know, the whole theater industry and everything, it's all fake and it's all silly. And sometimes you get to hang on to really cool stuff like that.
Yeah. When my brother and I came in here to make a sign for the film we were working on last summer, you graciously let us use your CNC machine.
Yeah.
So do you want to maybe take me on a walk throughout the shop and maybe show us what your favorite machine
is? Sure, of course.
And
Well, like I said, this is the woodworking area. We have the usual table saw and radial arm saw. So we have things for processing sheet goods like plywood and lumber. That's this whole side of the room. And that whole side of the room is the paint shop. So we build everything down here, and then we send it all down there one way or another. Sometimes it's too big, and sometimes we actually have to build it and then just ship it directly into the theater. Like this is all for Titanic. So,
so the staircase is going to be in the set for Titanic?
Yeah. And you see it's all bolted to the floor now so that they can run up and down on it and whatever. But you notice that it also really, really quickly comes apart so that we can take it in pieces. Sometimes we'll build a huge, huge set in here that can't come apart, and we'll put it all on wheels. And then we open that giant door. There's another giant door that goes onto the stage. And then we get 20 people just to roll the entire thing in there in one piece. So sometimes we do little tiny things. Sometimes we do things that are 50 feet long. That's the nature of this business. So we would rather not have this monstrosity in the middle of the shop. But that's what we do. Yeah. It has to go somewhere. It doesn't fit anywhere else. So over here, so that's, like I said, that's all plywood. Soft materials relatively that we cut over here. And this is all for metal. This is a milling machine that we're currently set up. We have a computer controlled aspect of this machine that we can put a piece of material in there and then do some programming, and it will do a bunch of processing to the piece of metal for you according to the program that you did. So right now we have it set up to do that, as we were making some brackets for the lighting department to hang this lighting instruments on the front of the stage that don't exist. So they come to us and say, hey, we have this weird application for this stuff, and these things that we need, nobody makes. And that's kind of the nature of this business, is that people are always saying, we want you to fill this weird gap that nobody has ever filled before. And this is the materials, and this is the needs you have to do for it. So can anybody make that?
Yeah.
So this is one of my classes, advanced fabrication class. They come to us and say, hey, can your class make these weird things? I say, well, absolutely. So whatever the curriculum is for the day gets changed, and then we go off to make these weird things for them.
Yeah.
So we also use this for other things in class too. We just happen to be using it right now for that. I can show you an example of that over here.
Sure.
So there's also, under there, there's a metal lathe. If we have to make custom round things, we do a lot of automation, a lot of computer generated automation and winches and things that move things around the stage. And we do a lot of adaptation of mechanical components. Like they'll bring us a sprocket or a gear or a shaft or a bearing, and they'll say, to make this work, we have to make this go with that, but that hole's too big, or this is too small. And if we have to make a hole larger or a shaft smaller, we'll put it on the lathe and turn it down until it fits, what make all the components go together. So not your usual scene shop stuff, but we're not your usual scene shop
too.
Yeah. At the highest level of this industry, if you go out and look at the professional shops who are doing, you know, the Broadway things and the touring rock and roll shows and things like that, they all have shops that are 10 times this size and way more sophisticated than this, as if it's actually a real manufacturing facility where they're making products. And they're making a product, it's just that product is usually used once or twice, or maybe on a tour or something like that, and then it's just shelved. So, but we have to do it with the same level of intensity and accuracy and tolerance and budgets and speed and all that. So it's a weird hybrid of worlds that collide. So we have metal cutting tools and metal drilling tools, another little miniature version of that milling machine, band saws for cutting metal, belt sanders for grinding metal, things like this iron worker machine, which does a whole bunch of different things. The machine I showed you right there that I had to set up to drill holes, this is one of those brackets. So it drills all those holes, and then we bring it over here and put it in here, and it does all these bends.
Whoa.
We have it all preset to little certain marks. So you set it in there, you push the button, and it bends it up. If you want a sound bite, I'll give you an idea what it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
I want to put it in there, I want to do a bend. This is an extra one. So. And this is, it's been changed so that angle isn't correct right now. But I mean, that's a general, I mean, this is not a machine like so many other machines and materials that we have in the shop. Nothing has been at all, zero of this has been designed and engineered and built for the entertainment industry. it's all been taken from the manufacturing or construction or R&D or scientific community. One of those sectors, somebody has already made the machinery that we need, and we say, well, we have to make this thing. We need a machine to do that. We have to make enough of them that it's worth spending $80,000 for that machine. And when I started here, nobody had heard of any of this stuff, because we were just building things with hammers and nails and screws and then throwing it away. And,
oh boy.
You know, and that's not how it's done today.
Yeah.
So you have to do things fast and repeatedly. And that's where things like this thing, this CNC router, come in handy, because we have to do huge square foot areas of scenery. So like you see that big, that those carts there with all those pieces of wood on them.
Yeah, yeah.
They have a notch cut all the way around the outside of them, and then some slots cut through the middle of them. If we did that by hand, it would take days and days and days of just doing it with a hand router or a saw of some sort, whatever. Well, we can take one of those sheets, fasten it down onto this thing, and it takes about 5 minutes to cut each one, and they're all absolutely perfect.
Do you keep up with what goes on in the drama department these days? Like, do you know
about
the
show? As I need to. There's a lot of people who, you kind of learn when you stick your nose into situations. There's so much going on, and there's so many people that are so overloaded with work that if you show an interest in something, next thing you know, even if it's a passing interest, next thing you know, you've got more responsibility than you wanted. And
yeah.
Something is your fault that you just asked a little question about. So I only know what comes through the shop, and I don't care what the designs are anymore. I don't when it leaves this shop, I don't care what happens to it. Basically, I just teach people how to use the tools, what they're actually building or when they need them by, and all that. That's out of my world now. So we just try to get them really prepared to go out in the real world and be really, really active, creative problem solvers, and know, most importantly, to look at a project, no matter what the scale is, and say, this is my skill set. This is what kind of tools we have at this shop. This is what our personnel can do. And can we do that? How long will it take us to do that? Do we need to job portions of this project out to other shops? And maybe it's too much at all. And then eventually, how much will it cost? How long will it take? So the whole idea of most of the students that come through our shop here they're really pushing them to be managers and business owners, project managers. So, and estimators and integrators and logistics people out in on a really large scale stuff. Very few people leave here after spending the money and go back, you know, to be their high school technical director or
yeah.
a regional theater person. Some of them do because that's what they want to do. But once you get exposed to a lot of really, really high-end, really cool stuff here, and you meet a lot of people who have come through here who are now really huge in the industry, and they're going to come back in and say, oh, you want to go work at your high school, do you? Okay, and then they'll say, check this out. Look what we did. Then they blow their minds, and they're like, yeah, actually, I want to do something really huge and really interesting.
I'm sure it's nice for you to just kind of, as you said, be in your own space. And you had your experience with the industry, but now
yeah.
you're just chilling here. But is there anything you want people to know that we haven't talked about?
As far as like what to, you know, parting comments or anything like that, if you go see plays or if you go see movies or if you go see television, if you have any interest in the industry at all, wonder what it, and the only reason I'm in this business is because I always wondered when I watched a movie, how did they do that? Who got to make that thing? That is so cool. And then at some point the door opened for me that said, you can actually do that. And I looked at my tools and my skill set and I said, my gosh, that is actually something that I might be able to do. Mm-hmm. And when I tried that, it was in fact what I wanted to do, and people told me, hey, you're good at this. You know, so it was, next thing you know, we're 35 years later.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Ben Carter, CMU shop instructor.
Yep.
It's super fun being able to work with you. I know I work for DR technically, but that's just right. Coming in and being able to see you all the time, talk to you about the dogs. But yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, anything I can do to help, let me know.
Yeah, all right, cool.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history. Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades Global Edition. One song per decade, 100 years of music in 1 hour. Get ready to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruising the Decades, Brad Savage. Brad Savage.
Journey with us now across the world and through the history of popular song. Welcome to Cruising the Decades, an examination of musical history, one song per decade. I'm Brad Savage in Akron, Ohio, USA, at the Summit FM Independent All Music Public Radio, creating this show for a worldwide audience, cruisinthedecades.com. This is episode number 144. And on today's show, Spirit of the late 1960s, and a famous song by one of the voices who inspired the Betty Boop character in the 1920s. Canadian rock and roll legend Burton Cummings joins us to discuss the power and mystery of radio and hit songs. And we'll do a little business on the side with Louis Prima. Cruisin' the Decades begins this week in 1914, and what we've got here is a monkey song. This is a silly song. Well, Collins and Harlan were very famous for vaudeville funny songs and songs that might make you smile and laugh a little bit and bring some comedy into the world. This song dates back to 1914, and the Palace Theater, 47th Street and Broadway in New York, which had just opened for business. Songwriter Arthur Fields had an early hit in his career with this one, and it's a monkey business anthem, to say the least. This is Arthur Collins and Byron G. Harlan, known as Collins and Harlan, the Abba Dabba Honeymoon on Cruisin' the Decades, 1914.
Chimpanzee. She loved a monkey with a long tail. Lordy, how she loved him. Each night he would find her there swinging in the coconut tree. And the monkey gay at the break of day loved to hear his chimpy say. Dabba 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 dab to the chimpy to the monk. Dabba 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 dibba dabba dab to the monkey to the chimp. All night long they chatter away, all day long they were happy and gay, swinging and singing in a hunky monkey way.
Abba dabba 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 dab means monk, I love you.
Dabba dabba dab in monkey talk means chimp, I love you too. Then the big baboon one night in June, he married them, and very soon they went upon their abba dabba honeymoon. Should have heard that band play upon their wedding day. Each chimp and monkey had some nutshell to Lordy how to play them. And now it is every night high up in the coconut tree. It's the same old thing with the same old swing when the monk and chimpy sing. Dabba 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 dab to the chimpy to the monk. Said the monkey to the chimp. All night long they chatter away, all day long they were happy and gay, swinging and singing in a hunky monkey way. Abba dabba 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 dilly dabba dab means monk, I love but you.
Babba dabba dab in monkey talk means chimp, I love you too. And when they brought folks, made man and wife, they shouted out, this damn delight, retiring from that abba dabba honeymoon.
Global radio show that spotlights a love of all genres of music and sharing that eclectic music over the airwaves everywhere. This is Cruisin' the Decades with over 100 years of music on like-minded radio outlets everywhere. Stations that value music and community. There's something special about radio and signals over the air. One broadcast to an audience of many simultaneously. A shared listening experience. Radio and 100 years of music. This is Cruisin' the Decades, Global Edition.
I would die if I should lose you now. Button up your overcoat when the wind is free. Take good care of yourself, you belong to me. Eat an apple every day, get to bed by three. Take good care of yourself, you belong to me.
It's Betty Boop on Cruisin' the Decades. Well, that is a song by Helen Kane in 1928, Button Up Your Overcoat. Helen Kane, along with Baby Esther, were very much the inspirations for the Betty Boop cartoon character that still endures in popular culture nearly a century later. In fact, Betty Boop came out in 1930 and then got a big resurgence in the 50s. And there's just on the cartoon, there's a ton of history to read about and learn about. And then the music of Helen Kane and the story of how Baby Esther, a black artist, figures into this equation as well. CruiseInTheDecades.com, 100 years of music, one song per decade. And I'm Brad Savage. We are very, very excited to talk to Burton Cummings of the Guess Who, coming up as a special guest later on today's show. But right now we're in the 1930s. See, we keep it sequential, one song per decade. This is Rudy Valli's orchestra from 1933. This is A Bedtime Story on Cruisin' the Decades.
Mother used to tell me on her knee to be in bed at 7 was just like heaven, to hear that bedtime story told to me. And as the stars began to peep, I used to count the little sheep, and then she'd rock me off to sleep so tenderly. It was a true love story, that bedtime story that mother used to tell to me.